This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listener.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
If you live in the suburbs, do you have a fire plan? If you live in a housing estate and a grass fire broke out and you needed to leave, how bad do you think the traffic would be? Is there just one road in and one road out? And when we think about fires, do we still think it's something that happens in the bush and doesn't happen in the suburbs? Well, yesterday we saw a grass fire in Ardea. So Ardea is just 14 k's outside of the CBD. It's in between Sunshine and Deer Park. This is Sarah, who rang Ali Moore yesterday.
I'm on the freeway and I just went past the Deer Park, the Ballarat Road, and the fire is literally 3 metres off the road. They're close to the road. Yeah, so it's a grassy area and there's a construction site nearby, like digging. I've seen 2 fire engines in the opposite direction trying to get through the traffic, but they're stuck in traffic at the moment. So I've just done an airport run and I'm heading back west on the ring road. In the other direction, the traffic's pretty choked up and 2 fire engines are stuck in that traffic.
So fire engines stuck in the traffic trying to get to a grass fire in the suburbs. Is this our future? I mean, how ready are we and how ready are you for fires in the suburbs? How do we design our new suburbs with safety in mind, whether it be the roads to knowing where an assembly point is? Is there even an assembly point in your suburb? Do you have the Vic Emergency app on your phone? And also in this half hour, do you go to your local neighbourhood house? What do you do there? Well, there are concerns that without more funding, your local neighbourhood house may be in trouble.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
How ready are we for fires in the suburbs? How do we design our suburbs with safety in mind, from the roads to knowing what to do in a fire? Have you started to look around at the grass built up at maybe some of the national parks close to where you are? Have all of a sudden, have you had that light bulb moment that maybe you live in a fire-prone area? Celeste Young is the co-convener of the Risk, Disaster and Resilience Network at Victoria University. Celeste, as we just heard from Sarah, who rang Ali Moore yesterday, she was on Ballarat Road. You know, Ardea is 14 k's out of the CBD. We had fire trucks stuck in traffic trying to get to that fire. Do we need to think about fire in the suburbs more?
Yes, I think we do, particularly what we call the interface suburbs, which are ones which are places like the border around the Dandenong Ranges, places like Belgrave and Dever Hills, even Melton, because you do have a lot of grass areas in those areas that can burn very quickly. And I think it's also about, it's not just about whether your house is at risk, but it's also how do you respond. Mm. If there is a fire, what do you need to do to enable the emergency services to get in and out there and deal with it as quickly as possible?
The new suburbs and the new estates that are being built, and this is something that we've discussed on this program, that I know ABC News have discussed at length as well, is that it can take people an hour just to get out of their new estate, simply to get to work or to drop the kids off to school or to daycare, because of the way new estates are built and designed. There's one road in and one road out. That makes me feel a little ill.
That makes me very nervous too, Rochelle, I have to be honest, because what they call egress, you know, your available routes to get out. If you are trying to get out all at one time, you do have those situations where traffic can come at a standstill and that's quite dangerous. So if you are in a high risk area, you really need to consider the day before, is it an extreme fire weather day or catastrophic fire day? What are my options in relation to that? So, for example, I recently spoke with someone who decided that they were just going to go to the coast for the day and that they would take their dog with them because it was they realised there was high winds and there were lots of trees around them, and their thinking was, what happens if a tree falls over and then we have a fire with this?
So I wonder, though, whether people in the suburbs are thinking like that. You might think like that if you live in the Dandenongs. You might think like that if you live in regional Victoria. I just wonder whether there needs to be a whole new level of education and conversation and design around thinking like that if you live in Point Cook or if you live in Mill Park.
I think if you live in areas that are adjacent to areas that can burn or have natural parks and things that have lots of native species that burn or trees that burn, absolutely. I think people need to be aware because it's not just about your house setting on fire. People also have lung conditions like asthma, which can be very sensitive to smoke. So when you're close to a fire, there's lots of risks that can happen. And also the embers are what set things on fire. So if you've got one of those really crazy winds, it can travel a number of kilometres ahead of the front of the fire and actually set things on fire. So, yes, I agree with you. I think we need people to understand the areas they live in and what their responsibilities are in relation to that so that they can make the best possible choices if they are either caught in those type of situations, or so they can do the planning prior to that. Because when you are caught in those situations, and if you don't have the information, if you haven't got a plan about where you might go or what you might do in those circumstances, you're not likely to make very good choices, and that can end in losses of things that you really care about or love, or it can also potentially end in death if you make a really bad choice.
So let's stay with us. Darren's in Orbost. Morning, Darren.
Yes, good morning. I'm really pleased that this particular point has come to the fore at the moment. We live in Orbost, and we've been through various bushfires over my lifetime living in East Gippsland here. And one of the biggest problems that we have had here is access on the Princess Highway going from here through to the border. Now, during the 1920 bushfires, the highway here was cut through from Orbost here to the border with trees that had fallen across the road, multiple trees, a lot of them. And that was more or less our safety access route and safety escape route for people from places like Cairn River, and also for access for firefighting vehicles.
Yes, Darren, now, that's such a good point, because this is the thing that yesterday we had trucks stuck in CBD traffic. But in estates, Darren, for example, there is no emergency lane a lot of the time for emergency vehicles to get through. That's concerning, Darren.
That is right. And it's the rules and regulations for this particular purpose are made by the governments and generally city folk. And it's not until something like that tends to happen in the city's areas that people become aware of that safety access. And that's something that I think that really needs to be looked into very seriously.
I couldn't agree more. And there's a lot of money to be made in housing estates. There's a lot of money to be made in town planning and suburb planning. Celeste Young is the co-convener of the Risk, Disaster and Resilience Network at Vic University. Do you think there are enough safeguards, rules and regulations? You know, I hate to be the nanny state here, but we're talking about people's lives and safety. When it comes to designing suburbs that emergency vehicles can get in at any time. Here's just one example. This is Jane, who's in Bacchus Marsh, and it says, our estate near Melton, surrounded by beautiful bushland. It's quite residential. However, only two ways in or out. It would be devastating in a fire situation. And I would say that Jane's not alone in that estate near Melton. I reckon most estates would be like that, Celeste.
Well, I certainly haven't studied that myself personally, but I would have to say, listening to those stories, absolutely not. They're not designed for these types of natural hazards. And I think it's also because if you look at traditionally when those were developed, these types of hazards that we're facing and they're being exacerbated, obviously, by climate change, are ramping up and have done so in the last 10 years. So we've got a lot of legacy areas that are built. I mean, even things like where you've got cul-de-sacs. So if you get confused and you're stuck in a dead-end road, you take a wrong turn. Because if you've got lots of smoke around, it's actually very disorientating if you haven't been through a bushfire before, and risk is something you learn. So I think there does need to be more thought about how we plan these estates for safety in relation to, you know, these natural hazards, because it's not just that, it's also things like flood and other areas that are low-lying, what that might do as well.
Janet in Dalesford says, also in these new housing estates, houses are so close to each other that a house catches fire is more likely to spread to the house next door. That's why all the homes in California caught fire. That's according to Janet. And Keith, who's in Carlton, says that Ardeer fire needed to have water bombing helicopters on standby. I want to have a chat to Elizabeth, who's in Preston. If you live in Preston, Elizabeth, have you thought about having a fire plan?
Yes, I have indeed. I live next to the creek and behind Northland, and there's two main streets that come in, but that they become blocked normally. And they used to have a meeting place for fire, and that's been all deregulated or gone since Northland came into, expanded.
Yeah, right.
And it's very dangerous. I've often thought, where would I go? And I thought, all the streets would be totally blocked around us. We're sort of jammed in behind Northland and the creek.
It's interesting, as life gets built up around us, Elizabeth, and you live in Preston, that you need to have a fire plan now. But this, I guess, is the reality. There's so many texts like this. Celeste, thank you, Elizabeth. Good to hear from you. Well done having a plan. A fire in Mernda, says this text, 2 years ago caused chaos, particularly by parents who were trying to get to a childcare centre to make sure that they were safe. It was quite near a grass fire. A planned safer shelter in place strategy and telling parents to wait for notification pickup would have prevented some of the chaos. This is sort of to the point that I guess I was thinking yesterday. In some areas where you live, you would think like that, you know, especially if you are in what has previously been labelled a dangerous area. However, if you're in Mernda, if you're in Preston, if you don't know your area, if you're in a housing estate, how do we start to just re-educate ourselves so that we all think like people in the regions?
Look, I think it requires a really broad educational process where people get together and do discuss what their particular risks are and what it looks like as communities. It really starts at the community level with support from government to do that. I also think that people have outsourced their risks. I've said this before. We now have to take on board that we own these risks. And I think with these housing estates, the way they're built, there does have to be some kind of investigation into how to make them safer in these circumstances, because things are changing. So we've got to change what we already have that exists in response to that. We can't expect that to function in the way it was designed to function in the conditions it was supposed to function in.
Absolutely. Someone's signing off on it, and surely it cannot be signed off until that you have safety and escape routes. So let's just finally, is anything done overseas? You know, do they shut down areas? Do they have certain planning laws in place in what would be considered a suburban area? Is there a really good blueprint that's being done somewhere?
I would have to say that I'm not aware of any at this point in time. I think Australia actually is way ahead in these kind of bushfires happening. We're right on the edge of the climate-induced natural hazards sort of area. So we are kind of like the petri dish for all of this, and people watch. I think this is emerging, and I think it's a conversation that needs to be had at all levels across government and communities and municipal sort of areas about how we're going to protect ourselves and each other in this changing climate that we now exist in and with these hazards ramping up as they are.
Good to get your thoughts, Celeste. Thank you. Celeste Young, co-convener of the Risk, Disaster and Resilience Network at Vic Uni. Gosh, there's some really interesting messages coming through. Hey, Rish, regarding planning generally, I was recently caught on the Westgate heading towards Power Street exit. There was a four-car accident, a lot of traffic. It was on a Saturday afternoon. The emergency vehicles couldn't get through to the accident because there was just so much traffic, who had nowhere to move. Sadly, as I sat there, I realised there was no emergency lane. Why do they allow a freeway set up so high to have no emergency lane? Wendy's in Eltham. I'm presuming, Wendy, you have a fire plan.
Yeah, my fire plan is not to be home.
Yeah, that's a good plan.
Yeah. So I live on a hill, like many places in Eltham. Where I live has a grassy knoll outside of it, across to a daycare centre and a car park. You can't get through. Even if you try to go in the car park, you can't get out the other car park. The grassy knoll is probably 10 to 15 metres maybe wide. There's a pole, like a fire trail pole on it with a padlock. I've asked council for the key because if I need to get out up the hill, they've refused point blank. Mind you, I haven't put it in writing. And where I live, two streets come up the hill and converge here. I've got no way. If a fire came up that hill, because the bottom of that hill is Edendale Farm and parkland area, so we'd be cooked. We would just be cooked. There would be nothing we could do unless we would not worry about the fire and the rocks doing damage to our car and just go straight over it. Whether my car would still work after then, I don't know.
Yeah, but and it's no looking at just planning, before. Right? It's poor planning.
Well, across the road from me, well, on my strip, in the middle of the road and across the road, it's just trees galore. And the minute someone tries to cut someone down, there's some greenie in the street that goes and reports to the council.
Does it get, what's the upkeep like, Wendy? I remember talking about
It's a nightmare. Yeah, so and contractors come and cut the grass.
Yeah.
But do they take out the dead trees? Maybe once every 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, I've heard reports of people even like mowing sort of not nature strips, but, you know, council land in order to try and reduce the fuel load as well, and then getting in trouble or getting fined for doing it.
The thing is, though, when you come to this time of the year, there is no grass to mow. It's just dead.
Dry.
Because we're so far up the hill, the water table has dropped by now, and everything's eucalyptus, so it just drops all year round.
Oh, so, Wendy, thank you. Thank you for sharing that, because you're not alone and this is a really important conversation. I mean, this has all started because the grass fire yesterday was in Ardeer. Fire trucks were stuck in traffic. And when we look at how we design new estates, we need more housing. We're building more homes. So are we thinking about how to get in and out safely? This one, Narre Warren, thousands living. It takes an hour to get out just to work in the morning. One road in, one road out. Developers save money in road reductions. So is that something that needs to change? Sue's in Shepparton. Hi, Sue. As Shepparton grows and becomes a regional metropolitan type area, how's development in your area in terms of roads getting in and out?
Yes, well, probably the same in that there's one road in, one road out in lots of the estates. But I've actually got some information about travelling. Before COVID, we travelled in Europe a bit. And on the motorways and in Europe, if an emergency vehicle's coming along, if you're on the left-hand side, you pull to the left and people pull to the right on the right, and that makes a complete lane down the middle of the road that the emergency services. And that would work on residential roads too. You just go left if you're in the left and go right if you're in the right.
Sue, I think that's a great idea in theory, right? And I would love for that to work. But I don't know.
Fabulous in practice.
Yeah.
Because we just need to be retrained.
100%. But I don't know about you, but of late, I have seen people almost run into paramedics, into fire trucks. People don't know what to do. They don't give way. It's so... I got tooted once because I pulled over to let a paramedic through. So I just wonder whether or not we would have the intelligence, the emotional and road intelligence, speaking of emotional intelligence, we're going to be talking about that later, to actually do that? That's a whole conversation for another day. Sue, thank you. Keep those texts and calls coming through. Would you know what to do if you live in the suburbs if there was a fire in your area? And do we need to be more planned? Do we need more education in that space? But coming up next, we're going to look at your local neighbourhood house. Have you been there? Do you volunteer there? What do you do there? There are some concerns that your local neighbourhood house may be in trouble.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So do you spend any time at your local neighbourhood house? Maybe you have in the past. You know, maybe you did some, I don't know, line dancing there. Maybe you learnt computer skills or English lessons or just went to a book club. So every neighbourhood house is different and puts on something that's specific to that community. However, there are concerns that many neighbourhood houses will shut down just because the funding isn't there. So Neighbourhood Houses Victoria, they've done some analysis and it comes out, according to them, that they need additional funding of about $11 million per year. But they've also looked at every dollar spent that you get back $21. So for every dollar you put in, $21 is put back in to the community. So the overall benefits, according to their calculations, is $922 million per year. So they have done their due diligence and they are all meeting on the steps of Parliament today to ensure that their local neighbourhood houses stay alive. Here's just one message from Jenny, who's in Coburg. Neighbourhood houses provide unquantifiable service to communities. Attendees not only learn valuable skills, but are provided with friendship, comfort in a relaxed, welcoming setting. It's a grassroots place of inclusion and acceptance. It's not found anywhere else. It's normally run on a shoestring of enormous hours of volunteers. They need to be non-negotiable. I have a feeling Jenny may be included and may be involved in some of her neighbourhood homes. But someone who is and someone who will be taking to the steps of Parliament today is Elle. And Elle is from the Castlemaine Community House. Elle, I mean, Jenny is singing from the same songbook as yours, I dare say.
Yes.
Can you tell us how you came to be at your community neighbourhood house? You started out as a volunteer because you couldn't find a job. Is that right?
Well, yeah, I'm at a certain age that, you know, I'm in an older age range. So, you know, living in a regional town, there's not much work available. And I went on, I think it was the Job Seeker at the start, but trying to find work and go to interviews was nearly impossible. And one of the people there suggested that I volunteer locally at something and I could make up my hours that way. It was part of like an obligation that you do for the payment. Mm-hmm. And I just walked in. I had no idea about the community house. I just walked past, saw it, walked in, went into the office and said, you know, what do I do about volunteering? And that's really how it started. And now I'm there 2 days a week on reception, which is just a phenomenal experience because I get to see the whole thing play out, you know, by all the different people that come in. And I've since I've been there, I run classes now.
What classes do you run?
I run sort of sewing confidence, like getting back into skills, especially around sustainability. So using upcycling clothes that you have, learning confidence in basic machine sewing.
Oh my goodness, I need to do this class.
Yeah, and that's also extended to, I work at the prison in Tarangower, the women's prison.
Really?
So all of this came out of just me walking through the door and I got immense support, non-judgment, just all the things that Jenny was talking about, inclusive. I could spout about this for ages, but I know we only have a certain time limit.
So you did actually, because just recently you were in England, I believe. I've heard a little story, right? I did hear this. It's a beautiful story. I'm going to let you tell it. But basically you were in England and you got on a train and you started chatting to someone who was going to meet someone, well, let's just say very famous.
Yeah, I somehow ended up in first class, which was in this carriage. I didn't pay for first class. And there was only one seat there. And this lady said, you know, that's fine. When the guy comes around, just pay a bit extra. It's so worth it. So I thought I'll do that. And we started to chat. And it turns out she worked, can you believe, in Dimboola as a registered, like a nurse, and part of the reason why she did that was she heard that Australians were can-do people and, you know, they get things done, and that's the sort of, you know, why she was out in Dimboola. But as we were chatting, I said, oh, you look really beautiful, you're so dressed up, you must be, you know, where are you off to? And she said that she was meeting King Charles to be honoured for her work. And this was specifically to do with her work in nursing and working in remote areas. So, I was kind of really impressed. And then, of course, because I spout so much about CCH, the house, I started, you know, she was curious, so I started telling her all about what we do there. And I think I said this to your other journalist or whoever I spoke to, everyone on the carriage went quiet. And it was like you could hear a pin drop. Like I could tell everyone was listening word to word what I was saying.
Yeah.
And I just jokingly said to her, well, you know, when you meet the king, could you possibly just tell him about Castlemaine Community House and the great work we're doing? And then when I got up to leave, everyone applauded on the carriage. And they were all like, you know, I think I asked one of the women, why is everyone clapping? And she said, because everyone wants you to know that what you said touched them, and that was the response or whatever. But yeah, it was a bit unusual. Let me just say that.
So did she tell King Charles? Do you know? Did he find out about the Castlemaine community?
But if Louise, if you're listening right now, and this gets to the UK.
Imagine if he just rocked up one day, you know, if he visits Australia, and you better have a cup of tea ready and some scones or something.
Well, that's it. I mean, I think, you know, we're living in a space now in the world where we're all closer to each other than we think. So it wouldn't surprise me if one day something, you know.
Oh, well, we applaud you too, Elle. Yeah. Elle, thank you for sharing your story.
You're welcome.
Got calls and texts on their local neighbourhood house as well. I know that about 200 people from different community and neighbourhood houses all around Victoria are meeting today at Parliament to ensure that their local house stays open and they get the funding that they need. Thank you for the work that you do. Elle, I'm going to keep your number too, because I wouldn't mind one day finding out the work that you do in the women's prison as well. It sounds like you're a bit of a go-getter.
Yeah, and just so that you know, none of where I am would have been possible, because when I arrived in Castlemaine, I was homeless. I had $30 in my bank account. It was because of the house that I'm back on my feet again. So that's a huge thing that I can pay forward in the work that I do, because I know what that feels like.
You are certainly paying forward, for sure.
Yeah.
You've got some serious coin in the bank that you can use whenever you need now, Elle.
Yes, thanks
society,
so much.
Society money, absolutely. Elle, thank you. Honestly, we applaud you and we wish you all the best today. So that's Elle, who's from the Castlemaine Community House. So many of you talking about what you do at your neighbourhood house. I volunteer at mine, says this message. My children all attended the early childhood centre there for their kinder. They now attend autistic groups and cooking classes there. It's a wonderful space. My kids are all at school this year and I'm volunteering to get some work experience back and to get my foot in the door in this wonderful place. Lorraine's in Patterson Lakes. Good morning.
Oh, good morning.
What did you want to share?
I go to Patterson Lakes neighbourhood house and the thought of it closing or reducing their services really frightens me. I commenced losing my sight in 2021, so I went from being a very independent person, able to jump in the car and drive anywhere, to really having my life limited to my local area. And I'm fortunate because I can walk to Patterson Lakes neighbourhood house. I've met some wonderful friends there. The staff are really friendly. They offer a whole range of exercise programs, and I know programs for little kids as well, because often there's gorgeous little kids running around when we're doing yoga and stuff. But they're lovely. They're lovely. Okay. I also go to book club there, and although I can't read, I can listen to books.
Oh, it's so good, Lorraine. I mean, this is, we talk about community and community connection and how do we create it and how do we foster it. It's already happening.
It is. Look, it is. And the staff there are wonderful. And it really does worry me if there's going to be some sort of cutback in funding and a sort of downgrading of services. Because for me and people like me, because I'm an older person, it offers us a wonderful social connection and it keeps us healthy.
Yeah. Oh, Lorraine, thank you for sharing that. This is from Lynn in Wheelers Hill, and you were talking, Lorraine, about small kids as well, so for people of all ages. Lynn says, neighbourhood houses are so, so important in terms of social connection. There we go. When our daughter-in-law and son came out from Germany with a six-month-old baby to settle here, she knew no one. We went to playgroup once a week at our local neighbourhood house, and very quickly she made contacts and was just starting to organise meetups and catch-ups outside of weekly sessions. Then, however, COVID sadly locked us down. But neighbourhood houses offer people of all ages opportunities to link in with others, especially at a time when dependence on technology hampers and hinders that social connection. Raphael is in Nutterwadding. Raphael, good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to ring in. I was listening to the ABC and I am the daughter of Phil Slattery. And Phil Slattery founded Neighbourhood Houses in Victoria, therefore Australia.
Oh, my goodness. You never know who's listening.
You never know who's listening.
So is this, like, this is, I guess, very well known in your family and the importance of it spoken about all the time?
Yeah, it's actually part of the history of the Neighbourhood House program. Now, my mum would have said, with the current funding issue, she went to bat for basically you had to have bums on seats. To get the funding. So, and it's not changing. And it is a very important social connection. And for all people, she would have people that were on very low incomes and people on very high incomes, people that were over time enabled to go back to university and to study. It's a very important community connection to have.
So how did it start initially?
So my mum worked out at what is St. Philip's Primary School. She was doing religious instruction out there, and then she went into the Neighbourhood House program. She had a history in social work, and she started. She got the manse. There's a manse, in Mountain View Road in Nutterwadding, number 25, which is now a community resource for the council. And they got that manse, and they also had the use of the hall opposite, which was a childcare centre and playgroup area. So they used the manse and they started up neighbourhood centres.
So it would have just started with one or two, and how long did it take to grow? Because, I mean, there are like 200 neighbourhood houses that are taken to the steps of Parliament today, and I'm presuming there's a lot more than that.
And there'll be a lot more, and they've changed names. But their funding is difficult. We have to look at mental health and everything. Look, I was, at that time, I was probably 10, 12 years old. I'm now 65. And they had holiday happenings. They had the local school. They had different activities and festivals and things. So there's a lot of history. I have a lot of the history in some books at home. and Now It Flows and is one of the books. And there's a lot of writings on it, which I believe the neighbourhood centres have. But I think the most important things that Mum would say, coming from her grave now of being over 100 years old, is it's about social connection and about people being kind and generous of spirit.
Raphael, that's what I'm getting on text. And Leah sends this message and she says, Rish, we're on our way to Parliament House. We're from Creswick. Our food assistance program is awesome, but sadly it's growing. So thank you for this segment. All the best. And there are people from all across Victoria. Thank you so much for calling and sharing your story. And thank goodness your mum and did what she did.
I know, because look what it's, we've got 200,000.
I know. You must be so proud. Every time you walk past one, you must just smile.
And I just sort of say, well, my mum started this. Oh. So, you know, she had a great group of women around her and blokes. And, you know, there's great history of it. So so go to the neighbourhood houses.
What a legacy. Thank you so much for calling through.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
This, thank you, Raphael. Her mum started Neighbourhood House. Wowee. I love it. Just when you just never, seriously, you never know who's listening. This message has come through, just one of the many on Neighbourhood Houses. It says, just quietly, they are the most important social places in Victoria. About 34 years ago, I did a couple of VCE classes there, which were just wonderful, had the most wonderful teacher. Shout out to Rita. So Rita, if you're listening. Years later, a friend of mine's sister, who has an intellectual disability, did a regular cooking class there. This was in Flemington. The staff at the Flemington Neighbourhood House are the most fantastic people you would ever come across. I will always remember how wonderful they were and remember wonderful Kathy. I would hate for people not to have those opportunities. Wow, everything from cooking to kinder to yoga, you name it. You can keep those calls coming through as well. We started today's program by talking about fires in the suburbs and how we build new housing estates now and whether or not emergency services can get in and out. We had a caller speak about being overseas and in Europe and how everyone just sort of parted the seas like Moses so that traffic could get through. And I made the comment that of late, I've noticed people not only not stopping, but not knowing what to do. I got road raged because I was getting out of the way for an emergency vehicle. So I was thinking, actually just a couple of weeks ago, whether or not we need to talk about the fact of do we know what to do when a paramedic or a fire truck or a police officer is in front of you? Do you know what the road rules are? And this message came through saying, making room for emergency services. It actually needs education. We need to educate drivers via the media, maybe something like the Wipe Off 5 adverts. So if you notice the same thing as well, you can keep those calls coming through.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
To the war for another week. And Chris, what a week it's been. I mean, so much to talk about.
Can you believe that today marks 20 years since the Chasers War on Everything premiered? It ran for about 58 episodes. It created some of the highest ratings that the ABC has ever seen, not to mention some of the controversy it also created. Thanks to one of the many members, one being Dominic Knight, Chaser co-founder and presenter of Saturday Breakfast at ABC Sydney. Dom, 20 years, my friend. How did that happen? Where did the time go?
It is absolutely shocking to me, except that I look at the lack of hair on my head and I can kind of believe it. And the fact that so many of us now have embraced the joys of middle-age employment at ABC Radio, for which I'm very grateful. Craig, of course, does the breakfast show in Sydney these days.
And the Chasers is everywhere.
Too. Yeah, Chaz is still doing Planet America. So Julian's on RN. So we're sort of still in the building or various buildings.
You never leave. Once you're in the ABC, you never leave. How did it start though, Dom? Because the Chaser started as a newspaper and then yada, 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 in walks Andrew Denton. And then 20 years later, you're still going. So how did it all start?
Well, it started with, and it seems bizarre now, but it started with a man called Charles Firth graduating university after a very leisurely arts degree in which he edited the student newspaper at Sydney Uni on his soir. And he thought, as mad as it seems in hindsight, that there might be a business in starting a kind of, I'm not going to use the word professional, but non-student version of that kind of satirical newspaper. So when he was on his soir editor, he did lots of fake news, news parody headlines, things like that, and he loved that. And a lot of the rest of us, Craig and I and others, Andrew, too, edited student papers. And so we thought we'd start this satirical newspaper. So Charles is very good at convincing people to do things and got a lot of his friends together. And we started this newspaper back in 1999. I was in my early 20s. We were all in our 20s. And we raised money by scabbing the odd couple of $100 here and there from parents and so on and maxing out credit cards. And we ran this newspaper for 5 years.
Wow.
And 90 editions. And it was very disreputable and very poorly edited and put together, generally through all-nighters. But that was where we learnt to write jokes. And people in the comedy world discovered it. One of the first people who actually came across it was the wonderful John Clarke. Mm. I remember going and having a brilliant brunch with him at Fitzroy. We couldn't believe we were in the same room as him.
No,
he was incredibly supportive and hooked us up with some of the publishers, Text Publishing in Melbourne. And then Andrew Denton found it as well. And Andrew Denton, as it happened, was doing breakfast radio and commercial radio in Sydney. And he was thinking about going back to the ABC and doing some more TV. And the great thing for us was Sandra Levy, the then head of ABC TV, really wanted Andrew Denton back, as you'd imagine. And he managed to leverage that into getting us a TV show because we got on with him. We used to play cricket with him and hang out. And he was just basically our comedy fairy godfather. And so he signed on to produce our first election series in 2001. And then CNN and N, the first longer series that we did, he was the executive producer and taught us everything we knew about making TV. So he really made it all happen.
So, I mean, did you always just think you would be in publishing as the Chaser? Did you guys ever think, well, let's start here and our dream is telly?
Not at all. I mean, look, we'd grown up seeing The D Generation, another amazing troupe of Melbourne comedians, any of whom have done radio and things like that. Still going strong, of course, with the satire. They lasted much longer than we managed to. But they were great mentors too. But all of us used to watch The Late Show on Saturday nights on ABC TV, and it really formed our sense of humour, I think, making fun of things that were a bit lame. So we love that team. And I think we didn't think we were good enough to do that. But early on, bizarrely enough, Channel 9 got us in for a lunch to see if we wanted to do a late night show for them.
Mm.
And we thought, no, there's no chance. They'll axe us after 1 week, which I'm sure would have happened. So we said no to that. But then when Andrew Denton was willing to help us, we thought, well, maybe we should try TV. Who would say no to Andrew Denton? And we thought, at the first conversation with him, we had lunch and he said, you know, what do you want to do? And we said, well, we could write something. And then he went, no, you should be on the screen. And I wasn't very much. I wasn't great at that stuff. But none of us thought we'd actually be on the screen as opposed to out in some back room writing dodgy jokes,
wow,
which is what we enjoyed. So, yeah, we were dumb luck, really.
And given what was on telly at the time, like, what was the reaction? Because, I mean, you got edgier and edgier and, you know, some of the things you managed to pull off and say and do. And on top of it, it's off the back of news, right? So you have to be so agile. So you would have, I could imagine, you would have written something, planned something, filmed something, and then what, big news breaks the day before? Do you chuck it all?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You chuck it all. And the best ideas were often at the very last minute. And something breaks and you jump on it. And there's, I don't know how this works, Rochelle, but somehow in comedy, when you can be the first to make a joke or you just jump on something as soon as people are finding out about it, it's a kind of multiplier for humour in the same way that improv is. So people love a joke that's just on the thing that's making them annoyed. And so that meant a really frenetic production process, editing and things. We'd have to commission props very rapidly and costumes and so on. But we built this team, and by the time we got to the war, we had a quite well established team of people who worked with us who liked
what
the crazy stuff.
What a crazy world it would have been. Like, it would have been the adrenaline and the chaos in a good way, the ordered chaos. It must have
been. Not much order.
Yeah, well, yeah, okay, just chaos. Dom Knight is with you. He is, of course, the Chaser co-founder, currently also the presenter of Saturday Breakfast. We're talking in ABC Sydney. We're talking about the fact that the Chaser today has turned 20 years old. So when it all says yes, people say yes to Denton, they say yes to the Chaser, you go to air, what kind of reaction did you get, you know, whether it be from either people working within the ABC, you know, bigwigs, the general public, because were they just like, oh, my God, what have we done?
Well, Sandra Levy was great. I mean, this is back in 2001 with our first election series, because Andrew wasn't involved by the time the war and everything came around. But the first election series, Sandra Levy said, look, there'll be lots of blowback. That's okay. That's what I'm here for. And so we were sheltered from all that.
Wow.
And Andrew Denton also did a great job of just providing a little umbrella where we could do our thing. But some of the jokes were really outrageous, even in the first election series, and got a lot of blowback. We always did. We weren't trying to be outrageous. We were just trying to be funny. And our senses of humour probably now seem quite tame in hindsight. But we were just trying to make each other laugh in the writer's room, really. And because we all have very different senses of humour.
Mm.
If enough of us laughed at something, we figured the audience would as well. And that tended to work reasonably well. The war and everything did get big numbers, as you said, on the introduction, particularly with APEC, which I think got 1.6 million viewers or something.
I was rereading and rewatching that today. So that was, back in 2007. And just for how far you got in that and the shock that even you guys had with APEC, it's gold.
That was just things, and this is the joy of the Chaser that I don't think you could do now of those series, is if you go out with a camera crew, it's before everyone had smartphones.
Yeah.
So as we went along, people started to film things and put things up and kind of ruin the stunts.
By then, you're already in.
Yes, but so we could selectively edit what we were doing and choose how to tell the story. But we tended to find that a lot of the best stuff happened when we weren't even preparing it. Mm-hmm. But I get very nostalgic about the days of chasing politicians, and I think that was the really fun stuff. When you're running after Lachlan Murdoch in the street with some sort of stunt, I remember dressing up as a sheep and interrupting John Howard on his morning walk. I've no idea why.
Why?
We even got a DeLorean. We were often interrupting Mr. Howard. We got a DeLorean to see if John Howard wanted to go back in time so he could retire rather than losing to Kevin Rudd. That was pretty cheeky, but he went along with it. He had a good sense of humour. But the idea you can do that.
No, I just wonder if it would happen now. Just finally, Dom, do you think it would be on actual telly, or do you think it would be streamed? Like, would you just go rogue and do it on YouTube? Like, would the Chaser work now if the idea was fresh?
Well, I want to pay tribute to the ABC for their incredible support of something which did create a lot of political problems for them at various points in time, lots of awkward Senate estimates hearings. Maybe it would be YouTube now. But the thing that was so great about it was that we had a budget. The ABC backed us so heavily and the ratings justified it. We were able to
do good
things
old
like
days.
Building. We built a Trojan horse that actually you could roll along the road to see if anyone had learned from history you shouldn't let Trojan horses into buildings. Some YouTubers can do that, but we had the budget of a full television network. So I like to think that something else like that will be possible again. So, hey, if you're listening and you've got an idea,
I think 20 years later, I don't think our budget's gone up, man. I think it's gone backwards just quietly. Dom, thank you. 20 years of the Chaser. It's hard to believe. Mate, really lovely to catch up. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And if you see a Trojan horse at your door, don't let it in.
Don't let it in. That's right. Dom Knight, Chaser co-founder, presenter of Saturday Breakfast on ABC Sydney. We've also been talking about your local neighbourhood house. Around 200 neighbourhood house volunteers are meeting at Parliament today to ensure that their neighbourhood house gets the funding that it needs. This is a message from Paul. It says, we don't often hear from men in this space, but I'm on the committee at my local neighbourhood house in Montmorency. I plan to start running a men's support group there. Neighbourhood houses are integral to local communities, and any suggestions that they can or can't survive with less funding just demonstrates how out of touch our politicians are with grassroots community-based organisations. They need to get out of their ivory towers and connect with their electorates on the ground, not in their office. That's from Paul. Jennifer's in North Geelong. Good morning.
Good morning.
Are you connected to your local neighbourhood house?
I am. I'm very connected to the South Barwon Community Centre, which is a neighbourhood house.
Yeah, what do you do there?
The Belmont Toy Library has been running out of the community centre for more than 40 years, and I've actually been a part of the toy library for nearly 18 years. My children are grown up now and come to the toy library to help me, but it's a great community there, which is why I've remained connected long after my children have sort of grown out of the toys.
Nice. Yeah, and how good, right? Because toys are expensive and they grow out of them, and to have a toy library and to be there for 18 years. Jennifer, thank you. I just want to end with Roz, who's in Noble Park. Roz, what's your connection to Neighbourhood House?
Oh, yes, thanks very much. Yes, so I'm a volunteer at the Noble Park Community Centre, our Neighbourhood House.
Yep.
And the gentleman before would be pleased to know that on the we've got 5 men. So we've got some men very interested. We're a lifeline in our area. We run food programs, knitting, sewing. We've got a food pantry. We've got 1,100 people a week coming in.
Wow.
It's like one big, enormous family.
Yeah. And that's the thing too, isn't it? It can be to learn something or to access food if you need it. And sometimes, Roz, I think it's easier to ask for help if you're in your local community, if there's a friendly face, if you know there's going to be no judgment. And then what I'm hearing today is anyone that's been involved in Neighbourhood House then gives back to their Neighbourhood House. If I didn't read out your message about what your local Neighbourhood House does, I'm so sorry. There were just so many of them. He's just a little one. Rochelle, thank you so much for promoting Neighbourhood Houses. I was involved in mine for many, many years in Burwood. And this, I love the focus that you're putting on volunteers at Neighbourhood Houses. I run a monthly cooking program there with my 75-year-old dad. Oh, and closer to home, I'm also a participant. Last weekend, I learned dog massage. And this weekend, I'm learning how to make cheese. I need to join my local community house. Community is the hero and the purpose for these amazing centres. That's from Pete. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care, and we'll speak to you soon.